Hi, everybody. Today, Thursday, June 12th, 2025, and our friend, Senator Richard Black, is back with us. Welcome back, Senator.
It's good to be here.
Senator, I talked with you before coming to live. You mentioned that you watched the video that Tulsi Gabbard published about the threat of a nuclear war. And here is a clip in which Lindsey Graham is questioning the head of Pentagon in terms of the ongoing issues with the foreign policy of the United States vis-a-vis Iran, Russia, and China.
Stop in Ukraine.
I don't believe he is, sir. I think he'll
what do you
go
think,
until...
What do you think, Secretary? Is he going to stop?
Remains to be seen, Senator.
Well, he says he's not. You know, this is the 30s all over. It doesn't remain to be seen. He tells everybody around what he wants to do. Are you familiar with his military buildup in terms of armaments? It's well beyond what we need to do to take Ukraine. Listen, I think I like what you're doing. I just think we got to get this stuff right. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon because they'll use it. They're homicidal maniacs who are religious Nazis. China is an expansionist power who will take Taiwan if we don't deter them. Russia will dismember Ukraine and keep going if we don't stop them.
Yeah, he literally wants to fight everybody in the world.
It is true. Lindsey Graham is sort of the ultimate tool of the globalist deep state. The deep state is a little bit nebulous, so people sort of shy from discussing it. But the fact is that wars are not made by ordinary citizens. They are prepared and planned and orchestrated by very, very powerful figures. You can go back in history. You go back to the Civil War. Today we're taught that the Civil War was about ending slavery, which was not at all the case. There was an element, there certainly was a very strong element that of people that were active wanting to end slavery, but you've got to have the powerful industrialists to create wars. And in this case, the sort of the internet of the time was the Transcontinental Railroad. And you had Abraham Lincoln, who was a railroad lawyer, and he was connected with the big railroad people in the North. They wanted the Transcontinental Railway. Everybody knew it was going to be built. They wanted it to go in the North. The Southern states wanted it to go on a southerly route, and the outcome of that decision was a monumental economic decision for the United States. And as a consequence, you had these huge industrialists in the North who were making all of the preparations to make war. And so this is not new. This is not something that's novel to recent times. But I was just watching the other day, we were picking up old movies on Turner Classics, and we're going through a series of them that were in the early 30s, 1930, 1932. This is long before the United States ever conceived, the people ever conceived of being in World War II. And yet you can see movie after movie being designed. Hollywood is preparing people to go to war, preparing, sort of generating the wave of hatred and so forth. So what we're seeing today is nothing new. And what is new is this move towards nuclear war, this idea that we can get the jump on everybody if we simply will employ nuclear weapons. We've seen that proposed earlier in the Ukrainian war, where we got dangerously close to doing something that would provoke a nuclear confrontation. And Russia warned of it, And a lot of us who are against war also warned against it. Now I think the biggest danger has shifted to the Middle East, where Israel is one of the largest nuclear powers. They're estimated to have about 600 nuclear weapons. Now, the exact numbers are classified by Israel, but the news media knows you're not supposed to speak about this, but you can find sort of oblique references to it in the New York Times, Washington Post, I imagine. I haven't specifically researched that recently, but I know it's in major media publications. They sort of quietly allude to it. So the insiders understand. They're a big nuclear power in the same sense that China is a big nuclear power. Nothing like the US, nothing like Russia, but a big nuclear power. They have nuclear armed submarines. They have jet aircraft, nuclear powered. But anyway, lots and lots of weapons.
You mentioned the situation in the Middle East, and we know that the Israeli government, the Netanyahu administration, as Haaretz reported yesterday, they're somehow in a state of collapse. Netanyahu cannot keep up with the government. They have a lot of problems in Israel, but they want to attack every time. Haaretz reports that every time Netanyahu is talking about attacking Iran because of his position in Israel. I would wonder what's your take on the way that Donald Trump is handling the situation in the Middle East? On the Iranian part, when you look at, I talk with Iranians, they say that they know what is the red line for them. They're prepared to negotiate to make an agreement with the United States. But on the part of the United States, every time Steve Witkoff goes and negotiates, comes out and says something different. How you can get an agreement with this sort of changing the rhetoric every time?
It's my understanding that the United States and Iran had pretty much agreed on a peace deal that would involve lifting some sanctions and major reduction in tensions. But I think the agreement was naturally disliked by Israel. This may even predate Netanyahu, but Israeli policy has been to try to get the United States actively involved in a war against Ukraine. And so there's a little bit of a cat and mouse game that goes on, where Donald Trump, he's got midterm elections coming up, not this November, but the following November. He needs lots of funding, huge amount of money that goes into the midterms. The Israeli newspapers have published that a huge part of the Democrats actually got more than half of their federal elections from people who were very strong Israeli supporters. And I think about a third of the Republicans, their money comes from similar sources. This isn't simply people who happen to be Jewish, but these are people who are sort of acolytes of Netanyahu and of the whole war regime in the Middle East. So, to a certain extent, President Trump is at the mercy of this cabal of global billionaires, multi-billionaires, and this is the reason that when it comes to the Middle East, Netanyahu calls the shots. And now we don't know precisely where this is going. We have an announcement that came from the International Atomic Agency, which is part of the UN, and they've been involved in sort of monitoring the Iranian nuclear program for many, many years, for decades. And apparently there was a big push that was made to get them to issue a negative finding against Iran. I think it came as a shock to Iran. IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, issued a resolution that said that there was undeclared nuclear material and activities at multiple undeclared locations. And then apparently there was a fairly close vote on this. There were 19 votes yes. There were 11 who abstained, which meant they didn't agree with it. And then there were 3 no votes. So in a way, you could look at it as 19 in favor and 14 against. So a relatively close vote. But the resolution by the IAEA cited many failures since 2019. Well, why did they have to go all the way back to 2019 to dredge up and rehash old issues that have long been settled? And in any event, it appears to me as a very political action by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And now, what they said is one thing. Now, the reality on the ground in Iran is another. Iran has a fairly robust peacetime nuclear program. They have had it for many years. It's been very public. They only concentrated their nuclear material to a relatively low level, to where it could be used for nuclear medicine. It could be used for nuclear power, but never close to where it could be used for nuclear weapons. But I think the increasing aggression by the West has caused them to enhance their level of concentration. Now, they don't, as far as anyone knows, I don't believe any intelligence agency is assessing that they are producing nuclear grade concentrations of the uranium. I think it's uranium-235 that's the big one, and 238 I think is the more inert form. So what you're doing when you have uranium, you're separating the isotopes, which is a very sophisticated thing, and relies on this tiny difference in density between the 235 and the 238. So you have all of these centrifuges that in sequence concentrate a tiny, minuscule bit, a tiny bit more. So the Ukrainians, because of the inability to arrive at any conclusion, they did up their amount, but there's no evidence at this point that I'm aware of that they actually have material for a nuclear bomb. They are in a position where if they were to make a decision.
You mentioned Iranians, but
The Iranians.
You meant Iranians, yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry, the Iranians. I apologize if I misspoke. So we have this awkward situation. It is clear that the Iranians were prepared to agree with the United States that they would take all of their very concentrated material, they would ship it to Russia. Now, Russia has made it quite clear that they do not support Iran having nuclear weapons. They see that as a red line for Russia. They don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. So Iran agreed, okay, we will ship the concentrated material to Russia where it can be diluted and sent back in dilute form so that we can use it for other things. It's very expensive and it's very important industrial material. And especially if you have nuclear power plants and things like that. So they were fully prepared to downgrade their nuclear material by shipping it off to Russia and saying that only the very low level material would be held in Iran. But at that point, Netanyahu intervened and blocked the agreements from going forward any further.
Yeah. When you saw in this video of Lindsey Graham asking Pete Hegseth if Putin would stop in Ukraine, and it's so amazing that he said remains to be seen. Why is he so hesitant to say no? He's not going to go toward Europe. He's not going to march toward Europe. There is no reason. And because Lindsey Graham says he said it, Putin said it, that he's going to march toward Europe. I am not aware of anything Putin said in that sense.
No. I think with Pete Hegseth, he does not want to lock in President Trump on a particular political position. I think that's the reason that he was being ambiguous. We can stand back and we can look at the reality of the situation. Now, Lindsey Graham, he'd go to war tomorrow with Costa Rica. If he thought the globalists wanted it, he'd talk about Costa Rica being the greatest threat to mankind, and they're going to end civilization if the Costa Ricans, who don't have an army, if they were to become hostile towards it. So you can't give too much credence to what he says, but look, just take a cold look at it. Russia today is nothing like the Soviet Union back in the 30s. Back in the 30s, they had a tremendous population, growing population, growing industrialization, and so forth. Today's Russia, it is still huge, even though it's shed Eastern Europe. However, the population of Russia is modest and it is declining, which is a big problem, not only for Russia, it's a problem for the whole civilized world. I think Africa is probably the only place that still has a genuinely growing population. If you look at the last couple of years of war, in Ukraine, you haven't seen Russia, you know, smashing through and you know, heading west and running its armored columns up to the Ukrainian border in the western Ukraine. You've seen this tremendous slogfest, this trench warfare in essence, that's taking place within the 20% of Ukraine that borders on Russia. It's been a very hard fought battle, not simply for Ukraine, but for Russia. Now, Russia has a very powerful army, very, very well trained, very highly experienced, tremendous innovation in their industrial production, where their weapons production, where they're constantly one-upping the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians do a pretty good job too, but there's just this explosive development of military technology. But just imagine if tomorrow, if the war with Ukraine ended, and tomorrow NATO said, we're going to lay down our arms. We're tired of this. I mean, this is obviously fantasy. But if they did, what would Russia do? Could you imagine Russia's, sending, say 4 or 5 million troops into Western Europe? Where are they going to get 4 or 5 million troops? They don't have people. They have the ability to defend their borders, which they're doing in Ukraine. Even if there was no resistance, what are they going to do? Can you imagine Russian soldiers walking around, looking at the Eiffel Tower, looking around Berlin or what? I mean, what would they do? They wouldn't have a clue what to do. They couldn't, even if they owned it, even if it just were given to them on a silver platter, Russia couldn't do that. Russia's got this vast expanse of territory. They have endless natural resources. There is absolutely no motivation for them to head to the West. There's nothing that compels them to do that. And I will tell you, when this war ends, if it ends in a permanent way, which remains to be seen, it may be very hard, but if there's any assurance that it's over, Russia for the next two generations is simply going to be struggling to move from a wartime footing to a peacetime footing and rebuild their infrastructure and all of this stuff. The idea that with a declining population and a relatively modest population for a big country, the idea that they're going to expand and try to take over the world is nonsense. It is idiotic. There is no rational substance behind it. And so now, will Russia defend its interest right on its borders? Yeah, it will. If something happened in Georgia, if the CIA or MI6 were able to topple the government in Georgia, would Russia be a little more aggressive? Maybe. They had a war that's often cited that killed a total of 900 people back years ago, and you're still hearing about it all over the time. It's like, oh, they invaded Russia or Georgia, and they actually didn't invade. It started with the Georgians making problems, but I think the one thing that people, that they're really interested in peace, like you, Nima, the thing we need to understand is that Russia has no incentive to go west. They have no capability to go west. They're very powerful on their own border, very powerful, but they have no capability of going into these endless expanses that lie between them and the West. They just can't do it.
Senator, do you feel that Europe is somehow manipulating the Trump administration, or they're successful in this sort of manipulation that they're doing in Ukraine?
you know, from the time that Trump took office, he's been under enormous pressures. There are tremendous forces for war. There are huge American hedge funds that have been investing money. They've been placing their bets in Ukraine. And certainly there are ones who are thinking, you know, if we could somehow disintegrate Russia and break it up into parts. Russia has such fantastic wealth in natural resources. It's one of the greatest exporting nations of the world. People have this misconception that, well, you know, they produce oil and that's it. You know, you hear American generals, Russia is nothing but a gas station and an army. Well, this is foolishness. They are the greatest exporter of lumber. Who knows that? Greatest exporter of wheat. The greatest exporter of fertilizer. Greatest exporter of natural gas. One of the great exporters of oil, and a lot of material, a lot of machinery and industrial things. Weapons, they're major weapons exporters. India relies on them for all of its major purchases. That's always bugged the United States, but India is very nervous that they don't want to suddenly discover that the United States flips on them and controls all of their weapons. So they've always, from a strategic standpoint, they've gone for the Russian weapon. And a lot of countries look and they say, you know, we can buy really great Russian weapons far cheaper than we can get marginally better American weapons. This word has begun to circulate that if you're going to fight a major war, you can't just do it with a handful of weapons. You have to have the ability to sustain it. And here we were, you know, we shipped all of these M1 tanks over there. That was going to be the magic weapon that's going to resolve the war. There, almost every single one has been destroyed. They are not very durable on the battlefield. And so countries are looking, saying, why do we want to spend fortunes on an M1 tank, which is a pretty good tank in some ways, where we can buy three tanks from Russia that are maybe not quite, maybe they're marginally different, but, you know, kind of in the same ballpark. But it's one thing when you think about the tremendous defense industrial base of Russia, but then it's another when you think about the population base. In the end, it requires large numbers of people to muster great armies. And right now, Russia doesn't have large numbers of spare people. Relative to Ukraine, yes, they have a much bigger population base, but relative to NATO and the European Union, no, they don't.
Colonel, do you feel that one of these European countries, maybe the United Kingdom, is more involved in more manipulated when it comes to Ukraine, or you see some sort of differences that you see Germany more bold, more important when it comes to Ukraine? Who's the main player in Europe, in your opinion?
The United Kingdom is the great force behind the war with Ukraine right now. There are huge London bankers who have placed their bets. They've made money on wars in the past, and they intended to do that this time. What happens, you've got three intelligence agencies. You have the CIA, MI6, and Mossad, the Israeli intelligence. These agencies have almost a bit of an independent view of the world, and they have long range aspirations of, you know, where they want to go to war and how they want the wars to unfold. And when the national leadership in one of the countries shifts and becomes more peaceful, then the others just pick up the flag and continue marching forward. Right now, with President Trump, whether he's able to, I think certainly he does want to diminish the wars and the conflicts. And so I think you see a shift from the CIA, which was intensely active in promoting wars around the world, and they've taken a step back, and the push has shifted to MI6, which MI6 apparently was deeply involved in the drone attacks on Russia, which seemed to be a provocation intended to interfere with peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. And literally they came the day before the peace talks were supposed to take place. And so yes, MI6 is very, very deeply involved. I think they have the lead in terms of intelligence. And then France with Macron, he's sort of the front man for the NATO pro-war effort.
Welcome, Colonel Davis.
Hi, good to be with you again.
So nice to see you. And Colonel, we were talking about with Senator Black, we were talking about who's the main player in Europe, who's running the show in Europe. Considering the latest attack, the attack on nuclear bombers in Russia, which was one of the most crucial, important part of the Russian army that so far has been attacked by Ukrainians. Your take on that?
You know, I honestly don't know that anybody is in charge or running the show in Europe. I don't think there's one. You have some quarters where Emmanuel Macron seems to be taking the lead. Other times, Keir Starmer does. I wouldn't say that Rutte actually is in any of the leadership roles. I think he's more like just following whoever's in front. Sometimes Ursula von der Leyen likes to kind of seem like she's taking the lead. Kaya Kallas likes to step forward sometimes here. And I think it's kind of rule by committee. And then you obviously have the dissenters, like with Robert Fico of Slovakia or Orbán from Hungary. And then you've got a lot of others kind of just sort of on the fringes or on the outside. Some are kind of quiet. You have Meloni in Italy, who steps up for her side periodically, but she doesn't take a lead. And so I think that you really don't see anybody kind of taking the lead here. And I think it's just a govern. I said rule by committee, more like govern by committee. And let's all talk about it and see what we think today. And then you have Zelensky, and it depends on who you talk to. Some say Zelensky is actually pulling the strings of Europe and compelling them to do all kinds of stuff. And then others say, no, he's actually just a puppet and they're all pulling his strings, telling him what to do. I'm not convinced that in either direction, because there's countervailing evidence that suggests that each has agency. And I think that's part of the problem, is that nobody is actually running the show. And so you have a lot of people free to kind of generally want to go in this direction here, but there's not like any kind of coherent vision. There's no philosophy behind, you know, somebody being, you know, kind of calling the shots, which might have, you know, a unified vision and strategy behind it. And so things would have to fit into a strategy and they would be going somewhere. Instead, I think you just kind of have people going, well, We don't like Russia and we don't want them to win. So we don't want to admit defeat. So let's just keep kind of going and giving them Ukraine as much stuff as we can here. And of course you have Ukraine, and Zelensky is always feted as a hero. Every time he goes anywhere, that's had some comments earlier this very day, et cetera. He's always has the head place at the table, a place of honor, no matter where he goes, et cetera. So I'm not convinced that he's just the puppet, but because if he is, who's the puppet master? Who's pulling the strings? And I don't see any clear-cut evidence for that. So from my position here in Washington, D.C., that's about as accurate as I can get for you.
Senator, with the way that Colonel just explained to us, it seems to me that there is some sort of secret deal among the European leaders to the way to somehow manipulate the Trump administration, not by the United Kingdom alone, but all of them together somehow playing to manipulate the administration in Washington. Is that the case? Because I don't see Zelensky doesn't have any sort of leverage over European. What does he have to force them?
Well, Zelensky is certainly a tool of NATO. You know, he's not even elected president at this point. His mandate expired, and unlike other countries have elections during war. You know, Abraham Lincoln, he had elections during the Civil War. During the war in Syria, President Assad was very diligent about conducting elections. Russia has had elections during the war. The only one who doesn't do it is Zelensky. So he's an unelected president at this point. He's really a dictator. He's not democratically elected by anyone. But yeah, it is true. You'll see different ones jump forward. Starmer, for example, he's been very aggressive, beating the war drums, and reminds you a little bit of the way that Trump acts with domestic policy, where the president makes some sort of a statement, and about the time people are attacking him, then one of his cabinet members will make a statement, you know, secretary of this or that, and then another one will make it. And before long, it's hard for the other side to sort of get focused there. And also it presents the image that the Trump administration and the whole federal government is moving in one direction, which I think to some extent is very accurate. NATO does the same thing. They want to show, they don't just want to have one person that can become the target. They, you know, one person will go forward, you know, Macron is often the front man, but then about the time he's being hammered a little bit, then Starmer comes up, and then it just goes from one to the other. So, you know, to some extent, I agree that there's this sort of wobbly coalition, because, you know, the European Union, for all of the talk about it being democratic and values and all this stuff, the people of Europe do not elect their chief executive. Ursula von der Leyen she's selected by this somewhat opaque system, but certainly the people do not elect her. So they don't elect their chief executive. And when they elect members of parliament, there is a European parliament, the members of parliament can't introduce legislation. So it's a total facade. Yeah. The people have no voice in the European Union. And so consequently, it's possible for the EU to function where, yes, Ursula von der Leyen has a position and this one and that, but each of the individual presidents or prime ministers can jump up and they lead the charge for 100 yards and then somebody picks up the baton from them and runs the next 100 yards. But I think, as generally speaking, with the exception of the ones mentioned with Slovakia and Hungary, and now you have a little bit of a problem with Poland. There is generally this consensus that they've got to fight on. They've got to do everything they can to smash Russia. And partly, I think, if they could back up in time, they might say, okay, let's never do this. But now they're in for it. And they, you know, it's become, you know, a matter of pride to show that, okay, what we've done by bankrupting our populations and helping the U.S. to destroy the Nord Stream 2 pipelines and all these other things. They've made a mess of their economy. It's just disastrous. And so you have the leadership of these various more powerful countries in the EU basically just protecting themselves, because they know that when the war with Ukraine and Russia ends, people are going to sit back and say, why did we do this? And, you know, why did we ever believe this idea that somehow Russia just one day jumped up and stormed across the border to try to steal some land? Why didn't people understand that it started when we overthrew the government of Kiev and installed a revolutionary junta and forced Russia to come across the border? These things, you know, when the pressure is diminished, the questions will be asked, and it won't reflect very well on the European leaders who have been in power during this time.
It doesn't seem, Carl, that anybody is interested in the diminution of tensions. And with the latest attack on the nuclear bombers of Russia, somehow I was thinking, what is the main reason for this? There is nothing coming out for Ukraine and nothing positive on the battlefield for Ukraine. And it came out yesterday, or the day before yesterday, in an article in Financial Times. It says how AI is effectively being used by Ukrainians to attack Russians in the latest attack. It somehow, it seems that in the West, they're trying to say the manpower, the problem that the Ukrainian army has today can be solved by AI. We can continue this war. We don't need manpower in Ukraine. We can go with AI. You're taking that, Carl.
That's fantasy. That's nothing but sheer hubris and more arrogance. One of the biggest sins that we've committed from the beginning of this war, by continuing to go to pursue policies that had no rational possibility of or hope of success. And because we wanted it, we didn't care what the balance of power was. We didn't care what the capabilities of the two sides were. We just want this outcome here, so we're going to pursue it. And even when it began to clearly be manifest on the battlefield, on the reality on the ground, that our hopes and our aspirations were not going to be accomplished, we still didn't change course. We still didn't acknowledge reality. We didn't take the diplomatic off-ramps we could have taken. We didn't show any evidence or interest in even creating any genuine diplomacy that was focused on ending the war and bringing the conflict to an end under the best terms that we could have gotten for Ukraine. There were many off-ramps for that. We punted all of them, forfeited every single time. And now then here we're doing the worst really of all, because now it is increasingly evident that the Ukrainian, that the manpower issue at all, forget about AI, forget about drones, artillery, tanks, all this stuff for the moment. Those all have a place and they're all important, but it always comes down to manpower. I don't care how many tanks, planes, and drones that you have. If you don't have enough people to operate them, you're going to lose. And even for these drones, as critically important as they are, and they're probably the single most important platform in the war today. It's definitely supplanting tanks, which used to be the primary one, also supplanting artillery, which previous to that was the main one. Right now it is definitely drones. But still with the drones, as with all these other things, you've got to have a man to either hold terrain or take it. A drone can drop bombs and it can blow stuff up, but it can't take or hold terrain. You still have to have men. And that's where Ukraine is on a dearth. They are on a net loss every single month because they cannot even force mobilize enough people to come in and hold the territory. And they don't even have a fantasy of taking anything from Russia, but Russia does have the manpower to continue to bring folks into the fight here. So even though that there are significant casualties on both sides, Russia doesn't have as many because of the way they fight and the way that they prioritize firepower over maneuver and warfare. And the Ukraine side simply doesn't have enough to offset losses. So while the Russian is getting bigger in the manpower every day and bigger in the drones and the technology, Ukraine side is shrinking every day in the manpower. And it's just inevitable that at some point, the fabric of the army is going to get to a weakened point that no one can predict. I thought it would have happened before now, so I've obviously been wrong on that, so I won't try to predict anymore, only to say that the fundamental, though, still remains active and at some point will impose itself, and there will be some kind of a collapse somewhere. And then because Russia has so many more troops, they can literally just flood into the country once they break through someplace, and there's nothing Ukraine can do to stop it. So there is no practical, viable military path forward for the Ukraine slash the Western side to continue this war and to have this fantasy that they've been saying earlier today and also yesterday that they want to force Russia into a peace that benefits the Ukraine side. That's what Zelensky demands of Russia. That's pure fantasy and arrogance at the highest, because Russia is mocking it. They're laughing at it, and they're having plans on the ground that they have resourced in both manpower, equipment, and ammunition to be able to conquer by force of arms what they want on the battlefield. They don't care about this spin, because when spin comes clashing with reality, spin will lose every time. And we've been seeing that play out on the war. And as long as we keep going with this fiction and this arrogance and this hubris that we are going to get what we want because we want it, aside from what's reality, we're going to suffer a big time loss, worse than we can even imagine. And Russia is going to come out of this on the upper end, and it's going to be bad for us.
Senator Donald Trump, after a phone call more than 2 hours, has decided to let Russians and Ukrainians talk directly to each other. And he said that they can solve the problem. But the problem is not. Look at the memorandum that Russia is proposed. 33 points in that memorandum, most of them all related to the United States and Europeans and the behavior of NATO. I don't know why. Does the United States want Ukrainians to talk with Russia? We know that in December 2021, Russia sent two letters to the NATO headquarters and to the Biden administration. They want to talk with Donald Trump. They want to talk with the United States. Why they cannot get that?
You know, the the mechanism of this war has really gotten very complex. The reason that the war started was that NATO decided to move into Ukraine. They decided that they would bring Ukraine into NATO, and that was a red line for Russia. And the reason that it was a red line is that all of a sudden you would have a hostile alliance immediately on Russia's border, and they would be able to move nuclear weapons right into the country and just be within minutes of hitting Moscow and St. Petersburg. If you go back to the beginning of where it all starts, now the problem then, the war begins. And Russia is forced to come across the border, and we very nearly made peace within. Well, I say we, the Russians and the Ukrainians, jointly got together and they hashed out a peace agreement that was almost ready for final signature 2 months after Russia had crossed the border. Very few casualties, almost no property damage. And at that point, NATO moved in, said with Boris Johnson, the prime minister of Great Britain at that time, came and with the support of Biden, he said, look, get back to war, knock off this business of peace talks. And that's what they did. And since then, you know, who knows how many people have died? Who knows? Hundreds of thousands at least. And now what's so complicated is to unwind this thing. NATO, which started it by saying we're going to go in and take Ukraine, must now cooperate in a way that will sort of permanently say we will not go into Ukraine ever again. And so you've got, you know, the European countries that are all in for war, and they don't want to cooperate with that. I think the Trump administration would love to have them agree, but it's difficult. And for Trump, the only real chance he had of ending the war in 24 hours, as he had promised, was to cut off all of the American satellite intelligence, all of the Starlink maneuvering ability that the Ukrainian army had, to withdraw all U.S. troops, all sort of Blackwater type contractors, all CIA agents, everything from A to Z. And I think had he done that, I think the war would have ended, because Ukraine just at that point just couldn't, they couldn't have maneuvered, they couldn't have targeted, and it wouldn't have happened literally in 24 hours. But I think then you could have hashed out an agreement between the two sides. But the problem is that you know, Trump is like any national leader. He has political forces from different directions, and he had them even within his own administration. So the struggle now is, how do you get this permanent guarantee that NATO won't just wait until Trump is out of office, get perhaps a Democrat president, and say, okay, well, let's go back in. To me, the war must be ended on the battlefield, because otherwise, I don't know how we can actually provide the guarantees that Russia has to have for its own national security. They have to give their own guarantees, because we're just, the United States can't control a guarantee past one administration. And that's really what has created this dilemma for everyone, is that we cannot come together and give Russia the guarantees it needs to where it feels a permanent sense of security. The only security for Russia, unfortunately, is a powerful military force that is in a much better strategic position along the front lines than it was when it started.
Carl, do you feel that Donald Trump is losing his momentum, because he had the great opportunity to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine? He talked about it before coming to power. He mentioned everything, every aspect, every angle of the conflict in Ukraine. But right now, it seems somehow, as time goes by, he's getting somehow confused with the situation in Ukraine. I don't know who's providing him with the information, but it doesn't seem that he's receiving accurate or realistic information from the whoever that would that person would be. And on the part of Russians, how do they feel about the situation that they're dealing with the Trump administration, Carl?
Well, I don't think that Trump ever had momentum to lose it. Frankly, he came in with a lot of rhetoric at the beginning, but it wasn't matched with action. So I don't think that he had momentum. It looked like in at the April 18th, to be specific, he had Secretary of State Rubio go out and for the first time say, hey, folks, we are days away from walking away from this if we can't get the two sides together to make an agreement, because otherwise we'll conclude that there's no way that this is going to be the gap is going to be bridged and we're going to walk away. And then 9 days later, Rubio said it again. And then on May the 4th, Trump went on NBC News and said the same thing. And Kristen Welker asked him, when is that going to happen? What is the criteria for when you're going to walk? And that's when he started getting wobbly, because he said, well, I keep thinking we're getting close, but then something good happens. And then I think maybe, I don't know, which could get to some of your comments about who's advising him, because somebody tells him something that he thinks is good, which I can't imagine what would be good, but that's what he said then. And then now you had, Kellogg, General Keith Kellogg, just a few days ago, actually said in an interview, the national television interview, where he said, well, now it looks like Rubio's walked away from walking away. So now whatever they were doing in April has now gone and completely changed. So the problem with Trump, I can tell you for a fact, I know that there are some in his administration that are giving him the right information. I know for certain that they are, but there's apparently others that are giving him different information. You have, Mitch McConnell in the U.S. Senate, definitely trying to push him in a direction to go back towards Ukraine. Lindsey Graham, a really close ally of Trump, definitely trying to push him in an adversarial place towards Russia and a pro thing toward the Ukraine side. So whatever the positive sides are getting, probably Tulsi Gabbard is probably the main one that's giving him the right information. There may be others too, but I know for sure that her office is given the right information because a lot of it she said publicly. So we know where she's at on that. But the problem is that Trump himself, as I've heard people say who briefed him personally, they say that Trump listens to whoever the last one in his ear was. And then when someone comes in with a different word, sometimes that changes the view. If you don't have your own foundation to where you have an understanding as the commander in chief, what is reality on the battlefield and how complex issues at the national and international level work, then you can get advice from somebody, but you have your own foundation, you know, and then you make a decision and you move forward with it. But if you don't have a foundation, if you don't have that kind of knowledge, then you're at the risk of somebody who sounds convincing here, then somebody else who sounds convincing there. And then you have what we're seeing play out, which is, you know, policies all over the map, and then they change, and then now nobody knows. And I'm talking about inside the administration, inside the U.S. or internationally, what his plan is. So no one really knows. Colonel Black was 100% right. Trump could, and I think should, have come in and immediately, on 24 hours, he could have started the process right after assuming office and said, "That's it, we're walking." There is no rational path to any kind of a military success for Ukraine. Forget about winning. That's not even in the conversation. There's not even a version of success militarily. You've got to take the best deal you can get, negotiated settlement that will definitely be by this time in Russia's favor. There's no question about that. There's not a good one that's in Ukraine's favor, but there is a worse outcome if you don't take that. Trump should have said, because that is the reality here, we're going to walk away from this and we're going to leave it up to Ukraine, an independent country, to make its own choice. If Europe wants to get behind it, they're free to do that. They're also a free agents. They can do whatever they want. We're going to do what's right for our country. I will not underwrite failure and send more American money and give any kind of support for something I know can't succeed. That would have been a rational position to take and something that would have been plausible. But he chose not to do that. And instead, he's doing some hybrid. Well, actually, no, it's not even a hybrid. Now it's like he's just kind of going with the wind and just seeing what's going to happen. And he's not influencing Zelensky. He's not influencing the European leaders. And he's definitely not influencing Putin. He's tried to do that with all of them, and he's failed. So instead of showing that we don't have any influence anymore, we're not the indispensable nation that we used to love to call ourselves. I think that the only rational thing to do is to end this right now. And the last thing you asked me was about, you know, how this is viewed from Russia. Listen, I think that from what I can gather from talking to some Russian sources, they're mocking the West now. They laugh at us, and that means both us and Europe, because they say, you guys are feckless. You don't have the power to back up your words. We do. So now then you have like Dmitry Medvedev on June 3rd, where he says, hey, listen, this meeting we had at Istanbul with this, at least at the time, was a 12-point plan that we issued. That's not for negotiations. That's for a victory. This is basically an ultimatum. You will either accomplish this or we're going to take it with force. And they are resourced to be able to move forward, whether it takes them another 6 months, another year plus through the 2026, maybe even. I mean, they are resourced and prepared mentally to do that. And they have the capacity. And if it takes that long, they can conquer everything all the way up, even past the Dnieper River, if it gets that far. And we can't stop it. So that's what I think Russia's saying, that we'll take a negotiated settlement if they'll give it. And if not, we'll take it on the battlefield. Because again, one more time to reinforce what the colonel said there, that Russia is not going to trust anything that anybody says. And if they don't get a deal that they can control their destiny and their security, they're not going to accept it. And they will only do that when they can take it on the battlefield.
Senator, I think the outcome would be, right now, and with the current situation in Ukraine.
I'm sorry, Nima. I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to leave here. So I'm going to hand it back over to you guys.
Thank you. Senator, the way that Colonel was talking about, we know that Russia right now needs the United States to interfere, to come up and to find some sort of solution. If they go with the continuation of the conflict in Ukraine and they literally destroy everything in Ukraine in terms of Ukrainian army. I'm not talking about infrastructure, all of that, civilians, not anything of that sort. But in terms of the Ukrainian military, so what would be the importance of the United States? What would be the importance of the relationship between the two superpowers for Russia? Right now is important. The current situation is important for Russia. The new administration gave some sort of hope to Russians that they can do something diplomatically. If the United States, if Donald Trump is not able to deliver on that, and he's going to go the same way that the Biden administration was somehow doing nothing but supporting Ukraine, so there is no difference in the eyes of Russians.
Well, first of all, one thing that clearly we have the power to do is to control sanctions. And while Russia has done a miraculous job of dealing with the sanctions, still they're a tremendous impediment to their economic development, and they very much want to put them to rest. So there's a great deal at stake for Russia in having good relations with the United States. And it's my impression, I think that President Trump is quite sincere about wanting good relations with Russia. He's looking at having a relationship that is not an alliance, but it is sort of a practical partnership in many areas where our interests are not divergent, where we actually have shared interest. And no question in my mind that President Trump wants to go in that direction. And I don't think that it's simply a matter of him blowing with the wind. It's much more complex than that, because nations have great competing powers internally. And we think in terms, well, we've elected this one president or that one president, and now he'll just do what he knows is best. But it's not that easy. There are just enormous forces that come to bear. So I think it would be a mistake to think that Trump does not understand. I think he understands very well. He may not have the granular detail that you or Colonel Davis would have, or many of the others of us. But he understands, and he has some appreciation for Russia's reasons for being at war. And I think he probably in the back of his mind understands that they didn't want this war. NATO wanted this war. Biden wanted this war. Before him, Obama. It was Obama who really set this table for all of this to occur when he overthrew the government in Kiev. And I think over time he's gotten a satisfactory understanding. Now he has people like Keith Kellogg who, he's all in for war. How he ever got appointed to his present role, I don't know. But again, the president, he's being buffeted by powerful forces this way and that way. And he does what he can to maneuver between those forces and achieve the best outcomes that he can. So he's not an independent actor who can simply command the direction of global affairs, but he can influence it enormously. And I think he wants peace in Ukraine. I think he would like his obituary someday when he passes on to say he's the man who brought peace in Ukraine. He would have loved to have something similar for the Middle East, but that's long gone. But I think he doesn't want that line in the obituary to say he brought peace in Ukraine, but then he brought a great new war in Iran. He doesn't want to go to war in Iran, but that doesn't mean we're not going to go. It just means that, at least we have him leaning against it, not leaning in favor of it. So I learned that years ago when I was very deeply involved in the events in Syria. And I said something that was mildly critical of Iran. And I had said that Iran had missed a particular diplomatic opportunity. If they had done thus and so, then it would have had a tremendous positive impact. And I had a communication very indirectly, but it came from the Ayatollah Khomeini. And the message was essentially, you don't understand the complexity of affairs within Iran. You don't realize that there's not some one person who can simply just on the spur of the moment says, let's do this. And you've got all of these different forces. And and I sort of responded through these very complex channels that I appreciated that reminder, because it's true of Iran just as it's true of most countries. That you can take the simplistic view that this person is making this decision, but in fact, this person has a direction he wants to go, and there are people pushing from different directions. And I think with President Trump, it's a classic example where he doesn't have he's not holding a hand of all aces. He's got a mix. He's got a couple of pairs. Maybe he's got something a little better. But his poker hand is not a royal flush by any means. So in foreign affairs and in other areas, he has much more power.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Senator, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed the discussion.
See you soon. Bye-bye.